Nashville Writers Circle is an intimate gathering for those with a serious intent to write. The series brings in guest authors for a lecture and discussion moderated by John Siegenthaler and Will Akers. Nashville Writers Circle is recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Well, welcome, everyone, once more. The Writers Circle. My colleague Will Akers and I'm John Siegenthaler. As always, these Sunday afternoons are a high point. In my life, and I know I share Will's point on that, the Writers Circle, as you all know, we make up the circle. The Writers Circle is really a gathering of published authors. Want to be published authors, have been published authors, will be published authors. It's an opportunity to listen to writers who have made the tough journey of producing books and stories that capture the imagination of an audience. And today we've got two really distinguished and talented writers. Tom Wood is a journalist, but an author. His several books include Nashville, the American Self-Portrait, which he wrote with John Edgerton, and more recently, Karski, How One Man Tried to Stop the Holocaust. His investigative and business and historical journalism has appeared in the New York Times, in the Wall Street Journal, numerous other newspapers and magazines. Presently at work on a wonderful biography of General Frank Maxwell Andrews. As some of you will know, Frank Andrews was a native of Nashville, an American general for whom Andrews Air Force Base his name. He's a graduate of Vanderbilt, Tom is, holds a master's degree in European studies from the University of Cambridge. He's joined today by Becca Stevens, that's the Reverend Becca Stevens, the author of Snake Oil, The Art of Healing and Truth Telling. She's an Episcopal priest, serves at chaplain at St. Augustine's at Vanderbilt, founder of Thistle Farms in Magdalen, a residential community, provides housing, medical attention, education, and employment opportunities for marginalized women. She's been featured on NPR, PBS, CNN, Huffington Post, was named by the White House as one of 15 champions of change, named Nashville of the Year, Tennessean of the Year, by the Nashville Scene, the Tennessean, respectively. She was the youngest and first female recipient of the University of South Distinguished Alumnus Award, and she's written 9 books. So we're lucky to have them here, and as always, great good fortune to have as our moderator, Will Akers, who, distinguished author, heads the film program at Belmont University now, and without further ado, Will, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much.
Becca and Tom.
Am I too loud? Am
Just
I okay
loud
now?
Enough.
Just loud enough? Because I can be really loud without the microphone. Can you bring me down? Because I'm hearing a lot of me.
It's echoey. We're echoing.
Yeah. Let me ask you both the same question. Tom first. When you start a writing project, where do you begin in the same place every time? Or is everyone brand spanking new each time?
It's new each time. It's a new adventure whether it's a little internal newsletter item of the kind that I'm writing in my day job these days, or a book project. You're trying to find an opening, and Sometimes that comes easy. A lot of times it does not.
So it's not pushing buttons. You figured out how to do it, and you're doing it the same way every time.
No. I mean, that may be true of some types of journalism, business and crime journalism, and inverted pyramid stories. Those, after you have done enough of them, come pretty quickly. But for anything that's not completely routine, you've got that sometimes long process of trying to find an opening, find a way that you can get your feet into it.
Same question. Do you begin one the same way every time, or is it brand new and strange every time?
Well, I first want to say that I looked up Tom a lot about his history before we came here, because he's really is a real writer in my mind about how he, like the variety of stuff he's written and the breadth and the depth of it. And I was very, very troubled to find out he's younger than I am. That has really bothered me, because it's like I've looked up to him. You know that feeling of like you think somebody's like an author, or they've done something, but you know they're really old. And so they have time and they can do all that. And to find out that he's younger than me it's kind of hurt my feelings. But for me, I'm a writer, I think, in a different way, where I write kind of a pouring out, that I have a lot of feelings around the work and that I do and the folks that I meet and the stories. So I tend to just jot notes, and then like a word becomes a paragraph, becomes a chapter, becomes a story, becomes a book kind of thing. I write best in the bathtub. That's where none of the kids or dogs or people or phones or anything gets anywhere. So I built a whole bookshelves and table, and it's very quiet and peaceful, and I love it. It's like a kind of like an altar. But mostly I'm collecting tiny pieces of paper that kind of move into something that at some point, maybe someday, will be coherent.
Or may not be, and you'll go on to something else.
Uh-huh.
Do you start one project and stick with it, or do you ever give up on one and start a new one?
I stick with them. I mean, I've like written them in order. I've done it just about every year. So I started with Abington Press, and we did like four books. When I wanted to do something a bit different, I went and talked to somebody in Nashville that there was a new imprint coming, Jericho, and so I signed a two-book deal and just finished the manuscript for that, and that's taken like 3 years. So the last 10 years, I think I've finished about something every year.
That's unbelievably
admirable. Yeah, but a lot of them, Kay West, you know Kay West, mm-hmm. that writes in town, she calls a lot of my stuff booklets instead of books.
Well, that's not very nice.
Well, I want to say that publicly, that's not very nice.
Kay is our Dorothy Parker in Nashville, so she can be a bit of a acerbic at times. Mm-hmm.
Everybody's got, I think, has got the piece of paper with the two paragraphs that they wanted us to discuss. So, Tom, if you could talk about Becca's paragraph first, and then Becca, if you could talk about Tom's paragraph, please.
Well,
and ask questions.
I frankly haven't given Becca very much to talk about. I had to choose a paragraph out of the assortment of stories, and I chose to go with a few of my local history stories that appeared in Nashville Post in about 2008-2009 when I had a column there. And I don't have a book out at the moment, not one with my name on it anyway. And so I hope the local history angle is interesting. But I found Becca's book, Snake Oil, a really moving read. And the paragraph here is about a very, obviously, very hard experience. She's gone into tall cotton here. If you think about it, writing about suffering, you're automatically verging into the territory of Job and Augustine and Dostoevsky, that's that's got to be daunting. And yet this comes out so fluidly, and it reads to me like spoken words. It reads maybe a bit like a sermon. And
that would make sense.
But it's like any good sermon. It moves to a crucial point and does so in a very moving way, I feel.
Thank you. I can't remember what I sent you. What was it? Yeah. There's a couple I sent over there.
Has anybody got any questions about the paragraph and how it came to be and how she wrote it? I have a question. How did you pick it? What was it about it that you found interesting or that you wanted to share?
I sent a couple to you. I think I sent three or four to you, and I thought all of them were kind of like what he's saying. It is a style of writing, which is about, it's a feeling you're trying to explain in story form. So it's kind of a blend of theology and prose, and it's kind of how I tell story, and I thought it was just a good example of how that works, and that there's a universal truth in there, but it happens on a particular body. You know, that we experience something individually, but it speaks to some kind of larger truth. And I think that's how we make community, that's how we bond, that's how we change culture. All of that stuff happens when we can take the individual experiences and turn them more into something that speaks to a larger truth.
I mean, the thing for everybody who's trying to write is, you people say, write what you know. Sometimes that's correct. But if you write what you know and it's only about you and it's specifically totally your experience, it can still be completely universal, because this was about you and how you felt, but everybody is sympathetic to what you said, even though when you wrote it, it was just about just you. And you, so when you write something yourself, it can be about your own experience, and yet other people can still relate to it. Anybody got any questions about the paragraph? I can sit here all day. Yes, sir.
I heard someone mention the word suffering, and I am a writer for the Spiritual Herald newspaper, and I'm presently writing about suffering and music. So
oh.
I'm curious. Someone said suffering.
He said it.
Well, it just struck me in reading this that it falls into a tradition that's as old as the Bible. It's Job, you know, it's St. Augustine, it's Ivan Karamazov and Dostoevsky. Some of our greatest literature is about how we hurt.
And I think what I was trying to convey in that part about suffering is the idea that it's not something that just happens to us, or you pray it away, or it's not there, but it's a real teacher too. You know, and there's gifts in it, and trying to figure out, being in it long enough to figure out what that is, to speak out of it, and then not have it be the end of the story. I mean, if you're fighting it your whole life, that is the story. And if it becomes a part of your life and you move with it, it becomes a powerful tool for something else, I think.
I've got to go back to the bathtub. Do you write with a pencil or an electric typewriter? Because I'm too nervous.
Is there electric typewriters?
Yeah, that's dangerous.
Do you have an electric typewriter? That's awesome.
Don't take it in the bathtub, though.
I'm sitting here nervous thinking about wires.
No,
and
you know, I mean, my whole life is about trying to find this place where arts and crafts and justice come together. That's where I really flourish. And making your own office in the bathtub is like that, because it's a 1940s bathtub. It has, you know, like four handles. I mean, it's awful bathtub. I mean, it's not interesting. But I've just found a refuge, and if you find a refuge and you find a place to write, you better make it yours and you better claim it and go for it. You know, that's what at least I've been learning. And wherever that is, if, you know, it's outside, it's in the shed, it's in the kitchen, it's in your bedroom, it's in your office, wherever, like, celebrate it and make it yours and go deeper into it. I mean, I was doing the baths before I started a bath and body care company with women. But it was in that bathtub that you start playing with these and becoming a snake oil salesperson and making concoctions and doing all that. But I made it's a duct tape desk, so the boards don't get messed up by the water. So it's all duct taped, and it has slots and stuff for pencils. It's really nice. And I write by hand, but I also have a Mac Air thing, whatever, it's 11 inches, and it sits right on there, and I can type forever on it.
Yeah, the batteries last forever on that thing.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Where do you do most of your work?
Not in my bathtub.
No. I've got a little cubby at home where I sit and pound away on my little MacBook.
And nobody bothers you?
We built onto the house so nobody would bother me, yes.
Because if people bother you, you can come to the library, and they have little rooms where you can go and no one will bother you. So you can also work. If you can't work at home, come to the library and you can work here and no one will bother you, which is kind of nice.
Bill Carey's written a couple of books in one of these rooms, I believe. Yeah.
Who did?
Bill Carey.
Oh, wow.
The guy who wrote Dead Poets Society is from Nashville, and he lives in Los Angeles now, and he can't get any work done at home. And so he leaves and goes to the law library, and he tells his wife, if anything happens, call 911, because I'm at work and my cell phone's off. And I don't think he tells her which law library, so he can't find her.
Well, I think you have to do that almost, at least for me, is like, I don't know about y'all, but if I know I have a sermon due on Sunday morning, let's say, it's like, I will do everything but write that sermon. Anything. Like, I will go to the grocery store, I'll clean the house, I'll do whatever I have to do so I don't have to actually make myself sit down and write. Because it's a lot. I mean, it's a lot to do. And that's why if you can find some place that feels like, okay, I can go there, and that's where I write, then I'm much more likely to go there than just to say I'm going to start writing. Because I won't start writing. But you know, you can like go, I have to go in my cubby.
Yeah.
I'm in timeout. I have to go to my cubby. And there you'll start writing.
Well, there's a word for doing everything possible to avoid the actual sentence of having to start your writing assignment. Years ago, somebody approached me to contribute to an anthology of neologisms, made up words. And I created the word aglificate, which is the act of putting off a writing assignment.
Aglificate.
Yeah, aglyphicate, the Greek glyphos for writing. So my word got published in that little book right above Lou Reed's entry, which was a genocide, which is when your agent books you into a really terrible booking. So
everybody has trouble doing this. I want to skip for a second to something that came up at lunch, which is the evidently universal fear, because there were four of us writers at lunch, and everybody worries about I suck. And how many books? 8, 9? A lot? I have one. Just one. But I sit down to write, and I think, oh, this is going to be horrible. I'm terrible. I'm a fraud. They're going to find out. I got to give them the money back. It was great when I found out you don't have to give the money back.
Right, you don't.
That was my second job. The first job, I thought, oh, no, they're going to come and get the money, and they don't come and get the money, which is great, but I still felt terrible. Talk about that feeling of fear, because I think it's very helpful for everyone to know that everyone faces it.
Well, it came up at lunch because what happened was my husband and I have three boys, and the second one is starting his senior year in high school, and we ordered books off Amazon this summer to get him ready for senior year of classes. But we did it, and then you go off and you do your work, I wasn't thinking about it. And last week, I got a book, because I charged everything, you know, on my credit card. So I had forgotten I had ordered all those books for him, and I got in the mail from a bookstore in North Carolina a package. It was just addressed to Becca Stevens. And I opened it up, and it was how to write like cohesive sentences, 21 tips. And I was like, oh my gosh, somebody from the bookstore in North Carolina has read my book and realized like I'm a horrible writer and has anonymously sent me this like how to write a basic sentence, kind of mean-spirited textbook. And it was like, it really hurt my feelings, and it also made me paranoid that, like, who out there, like, hates my writing so much? And then it took me a few minutes, and then I called my son, and I was like, did we order a book about it? And he goes, yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, I forgot we did that. I was so relieved, but it brought up that thing that I don't even realize that I feel that sometimes, is that just that thing of, like, when you write it and you put it out there, it also means that somebody reads it and doesn't like it. That's the other side of it. And to be okay with that takes, I think it's a back and forth, like you get okay and then you realize you're paranoid again, or you get okay. It's a journey for me, at least.
Yeah. Well, one thing, you're always better off if you don't read the comments on the online versions of your stories. So as long as you don't do that, then you can maintain at least a modicum of confidence in your work. So.
I've got a friend that directs movies, and when the movies come out, his family is not allowed to mention the reviews, whether they're good or if they're bad, because if you pay attention to the good reviews and believe them, you're probably going to pay attention to the bad reviews, and that's going to make you feel bad. So he ignores it completely, and I think that's a good theory.
That's a good discipline, though, to really be able to do that is pretty.
To have a news blackout.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it would be, there's an actor told me this. He said that when a director gives an actor a note on a performance, he said every actor has the exact same reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, true for writers, is the actor's first reaction to the director who speaks to him is drop dead. And then the second one is, I suck. And then the third one is, let's roll our sleeves up and figure out how to make this work. And I think that's what it is with a note. And is one question, who do you give your work to give you notes? Do you give it to anyone, or do you just do it yourself and never show it to anybody?
I'm fortunate enough to be married to a very talented writer, and so I run a lot of stuff through Nikki, through my mm-hmm. wife. I've got a couple of other writer friends who will sometimes look at things for me. But if you're writing all the time, you usually don't have time to do that.
Because if I'm writing a screenplay, it's months between drafts, and so I've got to give the draft to somebody. Do you show your work along the way?
Well, I'm fortunate to be married to a writer, too, but he's never helped me out. That's so nice Nikki does that.
We collaborate on a lot of stuff.
That's so great. No, we read each other's stuff, but I don't think he would more edit like a sermon than a book. But I have a lot of people that help me write. I mean, whether it's folks from Magdalene, like working on the recipes for stuff that we put in the books. I had two editors on Snake Oil that stayed with me for a long time on it. And then I had an intern that worked with me for a while, and she did a lot of work just on, I was trying to do it where I was telling something from the memoir side of it, something from the theology side of it, something from the Magdalene side of it, and then something on the universal side in each chapter, and just making sure all those elements were in each chapter as it went through. So I have a community that I don't mind showing it. To people that you trust that know what they're doing, my weaknesses, I know my weaknesses pretty well, and it's like I really need a lot of editing because of those.
But you're happy to get the notes from somebody when they're helpful. And I remember
grateful.
I don't do this anymore, but a friend of mine's, his friend had written a novel, and I said, I'd be happy to give you notes on it. And he said, oh, no, not, I don't want anyone to see it till it's done.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, then don't send it to me then.
Right.
Because I don't want to read your novel and give you notes when you think it's completely finished, because you're not going to be interested in my opinion at all. All you want me to do is say, oh, you're a genius.
Yep.
And which I have also found people do a lot is especially in screenwriting, is when someone says, will you read my work? They really don't want notes. They really only want to be told, I weep at your genius. Which is what we all want to be told, except that's not going to help you make your next draft better. What's the hardest part of writing for you? I'm going to ask you the same question.
Go ahead. I don't know. What is the hardest part of writing?
What's the most fun part?
Oh, the most fun part is the hooks. I love ideas, and I love hooks, and I love imagery, and I love all that part. I love the creative part of it. I guess the nuts and bolts of it is the hardest part for me, which is why I have a team that works with the editing process. I love that. I mean, I don't mind it as long as I'm not just by myself, just going over the same stuff over and over. But definitely the editing process is harder than the first, like, oh my gosh, I just thought of that. I love that feeling. And you know it's going to pass. You know, like, that muses don't just hang out and sit around with you all day. You know it's like a breeze that's blowing through, and it's like, and you catch it, and you're like, I get so excited, like, happy. I don't care if I'm in the woods or if I'm in a meeting or wherever you are, and you get that feeling of, like, maybe it's an insight, maybe it's a new twist on a thought you've been wrestling with forever, or just words coming around or something, or the way I think about it is you see kudzu along the highway forever, and all of a sudden one of them looks like a Madonna. Do you know that feeling? That's how it feels sometimes. It's like, like the kudzu is a Madonna feeling, and that's my favorite part of it, and it doesn't happen that often.
Mm-hmm. Writing for me is more of an iterative process. It's deliberate. I wish I had moments of inspiration like that, but I usually have to dredge them up rather than having the muse visit me.
And, you're often on a deadline.
Often, yeah.
And so you don't have time to wait for the muse.
Right. My mentor at Vanderbilt, the British poet Donald Davy, used to say, sometimes the muse can be a real bitch. I often don't have time to wait for her to show up and do her thing. One of the disciplines that you develop over years of doing this is being able to summon something that's good enough on deadline.
And you can improve it. That's the thing. You get something written, and then you fix it.
Yeah, although a large percentage of my work comes out fully formed. I might labor over a paragraph for quite a while, but most of it is likely to stay as is.
So when you labor over it and finish it, then you go on to the next one and you don't come back.
I do editing and revision, but I find that generally what comes out first is best.
And why do you think that is?
Just the way my mind works. I mean, different people work different ways.
Everybody works in a different way. I mean, one thing, please go home with the idea that if your way is not her way, or if your way is not his way or mine, your way is still fine. I may have told this story every single time we get together. I don't know, as I had a guest in my screenwriting class, and he hates to write, and he's a screenwriter, and he's very well paid, but he hates doing it, and he likes to walk up and down the beach. And so he walks up and down the beach and thinks about his movie, and for 3 months, all day, every day, walking up and down the beach and never touches pencil to paper. And then at the end of the 3 months, he's kind of solved all the problems, and he went home, and he sat down, and he wrote this movie in 8 days and blasted it out, and that was his method. And one of my students, after we hung up the phone, talked to the man, he said, oh, that's what I wanted to do, but I thought that was the wrong method. So whatever way you can get the words to the page, whether you write at the law library or in the bathtub, is a fine way to do it. What's the part about writing that no one ever asked you about?
I didn't get to comment on Tom's paragraph yet.
Oh, please.
But I mean, I just didn't want to forget that part.
Thank you for reminding me, yes.
You're welcome. Do you want me to go ahead and do that?
Sure.
Because I feel like, it was really fun to read it, and I had some thoughts on it.
I want to hear them.
Okay. So did y'all read Tom's piece? Okay, because part of this larger piece about Nashville Now and Then, and there's like a whole bunch of articles, and it was, you know, it's a history. I mean, a lot of it is history, and it's good storytelling, which is what I loved. I mean, not just in the sample, but in the whole batch of what he wrote. And my favorite was when he told the story about the kid that wanted to procrastinate to get the whooping on Monday, and then they declared civil war, and there was no more Nashville school for 3 years, and he never got spanked, and that's how he... Who was it?
His name was George Campbell.
George Campbell, and it was like, it's that thing of taking what I loved about it, and he did it in several places, and you really do it in the article about getting the medical students to do our first 10 care in the 1880s, too, but he takes a very great, fun, illustrative story, and then it helps you engage in the whole history of it, which is hard to, you know, to pick out like a moment that describes the whole thing. And in the one that the paragraph that we were reading, it goes on to talk about, you know, the neighborhood and how, you know, the neighborhood watch, and you know, went to city council, and they're really upset about the hospital helping poor people and sick people. And right when I was reading it, I realized that out of all the stories around healthcare, it just reminds you it like never changes, how it never, ever, ever changes, and the issues of justice never, ever change. And he starts off with that one sentence about, you know, oh, don't worry, it was just about education, it wasn't about justice. You know, it served their own purposes still. And just that sentence reminds you that really in history, if you tell it well, you're reminded of the present. And he did. You did that. You did a beautiful job with that. I thought it was great.
Thank you. All of those columns, the whole series that I did of them, I tried to anchor each one in some present issue, because there really is nothing new under the sun, and we really did have a capitated healthcare system, just like TennCare in 1886 in Nashville. So. To answer your question, what do people not ask about so much? One thing is the way I fall in love with language. So in the Civil War story that you mentioned, the reason I had to write it was the account that I found from 1930 of the old editor of the Nashville Banner, Marmaduke Beckwith Morton, had written a series of reminiscences of the 1880s. It was published in 1930. And he tells the story of this this kid who was going to get his licking in February of 1862, but was given a choice. You can take it today, Saturday, or you can wait and have it Monday. And he decided to put it off. Fort Donelson fell on the Sunday, and all schools were canceled for the next 3 years in Nashville. And the reason I had to write this was the line from Morton here: "And the squire's licking will have to be administered in the New Jerusalem, where hickory switches do not grow."
Did you have something with your book, Becca, that pulled you through, like that one sentence made him write that piece? Was there something in your book that made you do it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really is about snake oil. I mean, it really, really is. That is a draw and a pull to me. It's that place where theology, justice, healing, just myth, all of that comes together. And I feel like, you know, the idea was to kind of reconcile myself to the idea of being a snake oil salesperson, to make homemade homeopathic remedies, and that's what we do at Thistle Farms. And we make them, and we bottle them, and we sell them, and we say not only, hey, if you use these products, your skin's going to be awesome. We say, if you use these products, you're going to help heal the world. You know, we were selling that, and we sell those products. We try to sell them. We'll sell a candle for $18, but I try to sell them for $100. You know, get as much as I can out of each candle to put back into the program and the women that we're serving at Magdalen and Thistle Farms. And it was like somewhere along the line, that's when I realized I had more in common with these kind of backwoods old healers that were itinerant than kind of a suburban pastor, which is fine, but it's like I want to embrace it and do it, you know, consciously. And that really was the thread that pulled me through. And then going back and hearing all these old stories of healing from people and remembering the people that were so merciful to me in my own life about healing, like really going back and remember thinking about the people that literally anointed you, whether it was, you know, for me, tobacco when you got a bee sting, you know, or it was somebody giving you an aspirin when you had a headache. You know, people that came up with stuff to help you feel better. Or cinnamon toast. My mom used to give us cinnamon toast when you didn't feel good. But remembering those stories as part of a long tradition and claiming that as healing. And then going back out and also talking about what crazy, just garbage it is how we do healing. And how, you know, I start with the story of Ernest Angley, remembering watching him, you know, from the shag carpet in 1970s in the den, and thinking, who in God's name is buying this bull? And there was like millions of people buying that bull, and just how horrific and how bad it is and how awful that when people take advantage of other people and use it for their own power instead of their own feeling, that drives me, and it drives me still. It drives me away from institutional church. It drives me towards community, and it's a passion.
I lost my question.
I'm sorry.
I come back to my other question for you. Did you read other memoirs before you wrote yours, or you just
jumped in?
You
mean my whole life?
Yeah.
I mean, yes.
But did you read any specifically, I'm going to write one, I better read some? Or had you already done it so much it didn't matter?
No, I didn't think about that. I didn't. I really think about the research I did was more on, you know, Native American traditions around healing. Going back and looking at all the Foxfire books from my youth. I don't know if y'all, did y'all remember Foxfire? You know, and about people drawing out fire and the thrush and how people did that and calling up Ezekiel and what that was about, and going to talk to friends about people they knew that were doing some of this work, and then a lot of talking to the women and hearing their stories and making sure I had the stories exactly the way they wanted them told. When they had an attorney call me from New York, from Jericho, because there was so much revealed in the book from the women's stories on the streets, and they wanted us to block out all the names of the women. That's kind of in writing a lot of times to protect people, just to block out their names. And it was like, they really want their names in the book. That is a big deal, to not be anonymous anymore and to claim that, both again as the past and then where we're headed. And so basically we all had to sit in a room together and literally pass around the phone with all the women. He would read the passage to them. He would read it, not like I could say they have read the passage. He would read the passage to them, and they had to say, yep. And, I mean, we were crying by the end of it, because to hear a stranger say, you know, and then her dad pushed her head through the windshield, and she came out of the car, and at that point she ran away. She was molested 2 days later, da da da. And this lawyer's reading it dispassionately, and the woman's sitting there going, yes, yes, yes. That was probably the hardest part of all of it.
You're making me forget my questions. Let me ask you about your research. These are researched. How do you approach research?
There's very little in life that I enjoy more than just getting into the clippings in the drawers back there from the Banner collection, or the microfilms down the hallway here. I spent many, many hours in this building, and you know, nowadays going through all manner of digitized newspaper collections that are available. I love that stuff. I do it for fun, and I will immerse myself in, you know, old newspapers and things like that. For a couple of my books, I've had to do archival research around the world in various archives, and I love the challenge of doing that, of having to learn enough of another language to do research in documents in French and Polish and so on.
Wow!
And it's just I'm just a nerd that way.
Do you ever find that you can get in trouble doing too much research?
There's no question I've wasted a lot of time doing it, but I've enjoyed it. So depends on just how carefully you want to account for your time.
Because sometimes I've done research when I'm doing a piece of fiction and find that the too much research has made me lose my way as far as what my story was.
I could see how that would happen in fiction. I've never successfully written any fiction because I have no imagination.
But, well, if you would welcome a muse, you might get some.
Well, that's right.
Quit dissing her.
Yeah. I did call her a bitch, didn't I? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you did.
Someone else did, and you just repeated it.
That's yeah.
So in the Fike Farmer story, The Lawyer's Last Gamble, how did you find that story? Or how did it find you?
I chanced upon that in one of the many books about the Rosenberg case. And why I was reading that, I cannot recall. But I was like, wait, Nashville? And this comes up in whatever I'm reading. I read a lot of history of all kinds and from all over. And if I find a nugget of connection to Nashville there, I always make a note of it. And so I did in this case, and years later went back and dug it up. And so I've got notes that go back to a little column I had in the Nashville Scene in 1992-93 that I have gone back to in more recent years and developed stories out of. I've got a pretty good file of this stuff by now.
And you're able to access it and find it. That's sometimes I write great stuff and then it gets lost in the computer.
This stuff tends to stick in my head, you know. I just love a good story about local history, and so I'll usually remember what's there.
With the Fike Farmer story, what told you this is going to be worth my time? I'm going to spend the time to write this.
It was when I first read of it in this history. It was like one paragraph in a history of the whole Rosenberg case. I thought, what would drive this guy to tilt against that particular windmill? And then I dug up a little more material on him, was able to find out more about it.
Have you ever lost something in your computer and can't find it?
Mm-hmm. I've lost a lot.
The computer, or just lost something when the computer failed?
I've lost both. I've lost the computer where all my stuff was on it. When I say lost, it was taken from me. And my first time that ever happened, I was writing a paper for Vanderbilt Divinity School. And it was back in the day when you remember you had a floppy disk and you had all your stuff on the floppy disk so that you could go work at Vanderbilt or you could go work somewhere and you put your floppy disk in that computer and then worked on it, then saved it, then pulled your floppy disk out. That was those days. And I had it in a backpack, and I was working downtown at, what was it called? Storefront Ministry. That was where I was working at Divinity School at Storefront Ministry. And somebody came in and took my backpack, and they started running. It was my very first time I ever had anything like just stolen from me, just like that. And the first thought I had was like, that guy is an idiot because all I do is run. I mean, that's what I do. I mean, like, I run. I was running triathlons, and I was like, I'm going to catch him. Like, eventually, I'm going to catch him. Like, he should have picked anything but running. You know, it's like this poor, probably malnourished homeless guy is trying to outrun me down Broadway. And I caught him. And, but I cussed him. And it made me feel sick. I mean, I yelled at him, and I said ugly words to him, and he dropped the backpack. And I thought, this is exactly who I was supposed to be serving and how I was supposed to be. And this piece I was writing was all about love and justice. And when it came down to it, it was like, you know, give me my writing back. Like, there's nothing in the backpack, you idiot. I'm a graduate student. I have nothing. You know, you pick this, you're an idiot. Like, yelling that kind of stuff. Mean, mean, mean stuff.
But he let go of it.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he was going to definitely let go of it. But it was like, I didn't have to tear him up in the middle of all that, you know, grabbing it back and doing all that. It was just, and that was the first time it's like, there's more important things than losing some writing. There's a lot more important stuff than some words. They're not all precious pearls. They're truly not. And if I lost a book, it wouldn't be that big a deal.
I'm much more nervous about mine. I've got 3 hard drives, and it's up on the cloud, and I'm saved. It saves automatically, and it just, because I want to keep it. It may be terrible, but I don't want to lose it.
Yeah.
Do you back yours up? What do you do with yours?
Yeah, we had to replace a hard drive 2 weeks ago, but the Mac makes it very easy to back everything up. I take it as a given that a hard drive is going to fail after, you know, I mean, if it makes it 5 years, it's ancient, and you just have to count on that and back things up. Nothing digital lasts forever.
Now, the sad thing is then you have to back up your backup, but we don't need to get into that.
When you say backup, you mean like it's on a different piece of machine?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I believe that. I just don't have that. Do you have that? Do you have that?
Several of them.
That I'm going to get one.
The other thing, and I don't know again whether I mentioned this before, but do y'all anybody know about Carbonite.com? I think it's about $60 a year.
Yeah.
What is it?
Carbonite, like crypto. Carbonite. Anybody know where carbonite came from? I do. That was what Han Solo got locked in the second movie, is a big block of carbonite, and he wasn't ever going anywhere. And so someone invented this company, and you pay him $60 a year. And when you're online, every time you write something, it slurps it out of your computer up into the sky. And so then if your computer's stolen, you just go back up to your account on Carbonite and put it on the new computer. That's worth $60.
Did y'all know that?
I have used carbon paper.
Have y'all used it? That's awesome.
That's where the cloud is.
It's somewhere in the cloud, someplace. But it's carbonite.com. And it's, I think, and it, they apparently you can put anything you want up there unlimited for $60 a year. I mean, it's peace of mind for me, because as you might have guessed, I'm a little nervous.
I'm definitely doing that.
What, when you did this book, did you know what the structure was going to be when you started, or did you shuffle it around, or did it, how did it change and grow and morph or not?
I knew I wanted it to be, I wanted it, honestly, what I pitched was a scratch and sniff book. Like at the beginning of each chapter, like when I talk about the healing properties of lavender, that you could go and breathe in lavender. How much fun would that be? Well, that got shot down.
Oh.
I don't know.
Production costs probably.
Probably. It's like they don't do a lot of scratch and sniff herbal books anymore. That's gone out of fashion. But they did put recipes in it. So it started with, I wanted like really practical recipes about people literally claiming healing for themselves as healers, the gifts we could offer each other. And I call them like, you know, cousins to the casseroles for the South, you know, that you could bring oils places like we bring it. And I knew that part, that that would be the beginning. And I knew I wanted to tell the story of my own abuse as a kid. But I didn't want it to be like really morose, like just like, ugh, who wants to read all that? But just piece it, have a little bits of it to help maybe authenticate the idea that after my father's death, after the sexual abuse, after all that, that there was some grounding for being open to what practical, realistic healing looked like. So I knew that, but so I pieced it throughout the story.
And did that change, or did you stick with it pretty much?
I think I stuck with it. I mean, I think I stuck with it pretty well.
And your piece on Frank Andrews, did it have its form and stay there?
The piece that mm-hmm. that's in
the
here.
The one we read.
Yeah, that's actually an outgrowth of a full biography project that I was already 4 years into when I wrote this, and it's 4 years on now, and I still don't have a book, but I'm bound and determined to get that done one of these days. And
so you have multiple books going on at the same time?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, it's all a matter of whether you can find anybody who's going to pay for a book. And, you know, I've got book ideas on the shelf. I've got domain names reserved for things like piratesoftheconfederacy.com, because I've happened upon a whole cadre of these literal pirates who were involved in trying to hijack Northern commerce during the war. So, you know, I keep a lot of, I don't do anything in a linear way. Probably a little ADHD going on there, but I've got a lot of projects going on at once.
That's okay.
I've got too many of them, too. Becca, would you read what I underlined here? And I want to talk about that because I really like that quote in the book.
It's sad to think that some of our sweetest dreams die when we can't imagine them coming true, and we choose to let them fade silently into the bright light of day.
Where did that come from?
This is the part of the book where it's knowing that the idea of what Magdalene would look like was already in my head, but the reality hadn't come to be yet. And knowing that for a lot of us, we have a lot of ideas. Maybe it's just an idea about what we want to write, or it's an idea of something we want to start. But there's that space between thinking of it and then the practicality and the actually doing of it? And why do so many of those things die? You know, and what is it? And it is, it's a sad thing to me. It's like, I think you can grieve an inspired thought. I think you can grieve, like, this is a dream I had. I really wanted to open, you know, a restaurant, and it never happened. That you can grieve that stuff. And that was a time when my husband was on the road. I had two kids, and I hadn't started Magdalene yet, and it had been in my head like 2 years. And it was knowing that it's like, if I don't do it, it's gonna die. And that's when I was right down here. I was on right by right across the street from the storefront ministry was the Classic Cat. Do y'all remember the Classic Cat?
No.
And there was that 12-foot picture of the woman dressed in a cat suit, and I was putting my son in the car after work, and he was like 4 years old, and I was wrestling with him, and he said, "Mom, you know, why is that lady smiling? That's what he said. Why is that lady smiling?" And I realized he was looking at the Classic Cat poster, and like, it was such an innocent question, and I knew someday it was going to seem perfectly normal to him that a grown woman was going to be dressed like that, smiling. And that I thought, well, damn, I'm just going to do it. And that was it. And I never looked back. So that's what that was about.
And I underline that thinking about some project you might be writing on that you don't want to let die. Who's got questions for us?
I do, yes.
How do your day jobs affect your writing or help your writing?
Well, the answer in my case is not very exciting. I'm a staff writer for a law firm, and I just put on my work shoes and go do my thing. Kind of turn off half my brain during the week, and I work on my own writing projects over the weekends mostly.
I write mine early in the morning. That's when I write, and then I go to work, and I come back, and sometimes I work at night, but I don't function very well after about 7 o'clock at night. I can't write unless I'm terrified. Then I can write a lot, but I've got to have some really scary deadline to make me do that, but normally I don't write. I write in the morning, and then I go to work during the day.
Mostly what I'm writing is stuff that's been going on all day long. I don't think of it really as a day job. I mean, priesthood's not really a day job. You're just out doing stuff. Sometimes it's in the woods writing, and sometimes it's helping somebody and not writing, and sometimes it's, you know, I don't know. It's not like that. I mean, I don't know. I just take my writing with me to work.
Well, you got lots of little pieces of paper.
Yeah.
That you then deal
with. That I'm putting on carbonite.
There we go. Who else? Yes, sir.
Reverend Stevens, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
You mentioned the campus.
Uh-huh.
Getting the support for your nonprofit. I mean, $100 donation.
Right.
How some of the nonprofit and we're experiencing the same sort of issue.
Uh-huh.
Can you share some tips on how you're able to get the general public to see the value of what you're doing and kind of get them to open up their purses?
Sure, and I think storytelling is the key to it. I think making the story real is the best so that the candle comes to life, or I don't know what your nonprofit is. Huh? Oh, yeah. I know all, yeah. And telling good stories and getting, I mean, you guys have stories of volunteers that come in and people that come in and do stuff. You read about that. But for me, the better I can make the story come alive and tell it, the more people are a part of it, you know, and the wider that net gets cast. And I will tell you, though, about a year and a half ago when NPR came and did the series on our social enterprise in Magdalene, I thought that was going to be our big break, like they were going to tell that story. It was a 4-part series nationally on NPR. It was going to be fine after that. And it was hard because it ended up that we had a homicide while they were here. And we thought, we begged them to pull telling the story. And I was just panicked. I thought, this is really not going to go well for us, and we're going to be judged, and it's going to be bad. They aired it. It went on. You know, I mean, the board at NPR called us and said, we are airing it, and we are disclosing what happened while we were there, the whole thing. So what happened was, though, and the lesson I learned was that if you are doing the right thing, and if you're doing it with integrity, and you're out there, and you're telling the story, even if it has a sad ending, and all our not-for-profits have good stories and bad stories, even with those, people will join in and try to help because people want to hope. And I think sometimes we don't tell a good story because we sugarcoat it so much as a not-for-profit, thinking everybody's going to judge us and think, you know, she's an idiot. What does she know about running a business, or what does he know about running the Earth Matters or whatever? And so you spin it so much, it becomes not a good story. It's a cliched story. And I think we have to get better in not-for-profit in telling the real story about how hard it is and how troubled those fields are that you're tending. How troubled. And how beautiful it is when we keep working even in spite of that. And some of the most beautiful stories can be some of the hardest ones to tell. And that's one thing. And the other thing is, I think the other story that we do not tell well, that we need to tell well, is how much we benefit the cities and the communities that we're in. So that we're seen as a charity. Thistle Farms is seen as a complete charity. But we don't take any federal or state money, and we save the city of Nashville over $500,000 a year. Just by employing the 45 women we employ, and the taxes we pay, and the court restitution costs we pay, and the savings in incarceration and arrests and all of that. And you realize we're a player in this city, and we do not know how to speak that power truth that is part of our story in not-for-profit work very well either. Sorry, that was too long. Sorry.
It's the perfect one.
Okay.
Perfect. What it all comes back to writing, and she's rewriting the story of her charity, her nonprofit, as she goes. So, and we're back to, you get a first draft, you rewrite it, it changes, you rewrite it, and it changes again, and you keep changing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not exactly like writing, but it still has a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about telling a story and adjusting the story as you go. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Recorded any of your books? Mm-hmm. I haven't done that yet, but
yeah, and I liked it. I love it. I mean, I love the podcast app. I love hearing, you know, the stories on This American Life and how that works. And I think it's a great. I mean, it's a great way for people to enter into the writing in a new way. And I mean, I love Audible. I mean, I loved reading. I read my whole book on that. Like in a microphone where they do it on Kindle or whatever. And I was really excited that they asked me to read my own book. I thought that was really fun. And I kept thinking the engineer's going to fall sound asleep, surely to God. You know, because you're just sitting there like, somebody's reading 200 pages. They stay awake through that whole thing. I don't know how that works, but it'd be like, for me, you know, anyway. I loved it, and what I wish is that we would get more creative like This American Life when people are doing audiobooks and having more music and breaks in it and a little bit more drama in the telling of it. I love that.
How long did it take to read the book?
Like all day.
In one day, though?
I did it in a morning, took a break in the afternoon.
Wow. Yes, sir.
Tom, your specialty seems to be the Nashville District. I'm not sure even what question to ask here, but what draws you to that? What is it about Nashville history and any segments of Nashville history that are particularly of interest?
I guess I've been interested in it all my life. I grew up here and watched the city turn into a very different place from the small town I grew up in. Covering that evolution as a journalist, it's always seemed natural to me to delve deeper into the history that preceded us. And as I mentioned, I've forever finding the past in the present. You know, I think a knowledge of our local history is almost prerequisite to really covering the city as a journalist.
Mm.
Yes. It comes from the
birth memory. Well, I definitely like this my whole writing journey in that book has got my mom's stamp just so firmly on it. I mean, you know, she, you know, when the lessons I think that you remember at 50 years old from when you were 5 years old, you know, are the heart of who your mother is too. So not only did she carry you in its birth memory, it's, you know, the mother line memory too of the, you know, of the essence of what she was and how she stamped on me. And I love, you don't even know where it comes from. And all of a sudden you're saying something to your kids and it sounds like your mom. Cause like, I can say like, this room is a shambles and I have no idea what a shambles is. I have no idea what a shambles is. And I say it and I think, that is not me speaking. That is my mother. That is my mother's voice. That is my mother's words. You know, and, you know, you're going to be a ne'er-do-well. Just keep that up. You're going to be a ne'er-do-well. What is that? But those are the things, you know, that you don't even remember where you heard it first or where it came from, but it's in there, isn't it? I love it. And I love that we call it up. I mean, you literally can call it up. I mean, do you have that stuff from your mama?
Yes, I'm sitting here trying to remember what all they are. There are plenty of them. Yeah, and I say to my children, and then I look back and I go, whoa, that wasn't me.
Uh-huh.
It was my dad or my mother. Yeah, absolutely. My children now recognize it. Oh, that's your dad.
Uh-huh.
What about you?
Well, when I had the Eggs Benedict this morning, I certainly thought of my mom, as I always do.
She was an Eggs Benedict person?
Yeah.
There you go.
Who else? Yes, ma'am.
I'm wondering if you all, as authors, what kind of social media you all use, or how do you use it, and how do you balance that with your day jobs as well as your, you know, writing career versus the social media?
I use it all the time, and we have a team of people that do it. I mean, if anybody is willing to like our Thistle Farms page, there's a... a Twitter account, Reverend Becca Stevens, and we use it to put out word. We have several people that post to that one account, but it helps us when we go to a city. If we know we're going to Jackson, Tennessee, then we want people to come out for that. We try to use it, and for us, it enhances it. So, like you put something in the. I had an editorial last week in the Tennessean, and then you post it to Twitter, you post it to Facebook, you post it to our social media in any way we can. And try to just keep generating some interest in the topics. For us, it's a national conference we're hosting in October, so we're just going to keep plugging away at it. And we do it through writing, whether it's editorial pieces or whatever, or just thoughts, or just to build a movement. And for me, the writing is a part of building a movement, especially around, you know, the universal issues of sexual violence and the healing of that and how that looks. And so if any piece of writing, if it's 140 characters on Twitter, I'll take it. If it's a book, I'll take it. I mean, I'll take any avenue I can get on it.
I'm pretty active on Facebook and somewhat on Twitter, mainly because I enjoy it. I interact with a lot of friends around the country and around the world that way. But I've set up pages for several different projects, book projects I've been involved with, and the pure sort of commercial value of sharing some of the content in a dedicated page like that and giving people a taste of it to encourage them to want to buy your book, it's been worth the effort for sure. It's very hard to quantify, you know, but I feel sure it's worth the effort. And my personal connections on Facebook, when I have another book to flog, they'll know about it. But I realized early on, you don't want to only get on social media when you've got something to sell. So,
I'm the opposite. I don't do any of it, except when my new book comes out, and then I'll start worrying about it. But on my LinkedIn page, it says, if you haven't had lunch with me in the last 2 years, please do not attempt to link in with me. And I get strangers every week want to be my LinkedIn, like I'm going to recommend them for a job, and I've never met them. My other problem is I just like to write. I don't really care about if anyone reads it. I just like to write it. And so if it sells, great. If it doesn't sell, not as great, but I'm still going to keep doing it. And when I was at Vanderbilt, I made a short film every year. I just like to make them. And the other students, I said, here's your DVD. They said, are you going to put it on YouTube? No, I just like to make it. And I don't care if anybody sees it or reads it, which is weird because when I have my book on screenwriting, I do like to hear from people that it was helpful. So I'm the last person to ask about marketing. I'm the worst. You had a question.
Two unrelated questions. One is the concept of writer's block outmoded. That's the one question. I mean, is there such a thing as writer's block? I know there is. If that's clear, you can respond to that. And the other one is, how do you let go of a word, a sentence, a paragraph that you think is the greatest one in the world and everyone's beating you down and saying it's garbage?
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, if they're beating you down about it, at least they're paying attention to it. So it kind of depends on who's doing the beating, I suppose, whether you have enough confidence in that piece of prose to stand with it or not. And I've been on both sides of that issue.
Well, I would just say that I just have... You know when the witch writes Surrender Dorothy in the air? I love that. I mean, I love the Surrender Dorothy, and I got hooked on it this summer. And so we did this whole thing that we presented to, so far, two different groups called Surrender Dorothy. And it's a day for women to talk about stuff and to look at stuff and about, you know, how do we birth new ideas? How do we surrender to love and to work towards justice and all these things? So my assistant, Tim, said it needs to be surrender, comma, Dorothy. If you say surrender, Dorothy, that means that the community needs to surrender Dorothy to the Wicked Witch. If it's surrender, comma, Dorothy, then Dorothy needs to surrender. And that's what you're saying. And I was like, no. I'm saying what the witch wrote on the broom in the sky from the movie. It's not like that. So we had this argument, and I'm thinking, I'm the writer, right? So I get to say like what I'm thinking and how we're going to do it. So I show up, this is 2 days ago, to the first conference that's come to fruition. You know, it's all over the church and in the paper, Surrender, comma, Dorothy. And it's like he did what he wanted to anyway and totally won in the end. And I was like, it was just a comma. It wasn't even a word or a phrase. But it was like, I know he's right. I know grammatically he's right. And I need to let it go. But I think it's lost something. And so how do you, if you can, you know, I have to let go of the comma. So yes, I struggle when people like, I think I have a really good idea. And they're like, it's not good. You have to let that go. And I've had it with products. I had a whole Moses line of products that I thought were brilliant. And I had a salt scrub called Lot's Wife. Isn't that awesome? And they took it all away from me. They wiped it out. And it's like every time, you know, you have to swallow it. It's like you have to trust people too that maybe you're not as brilliant and funny as you think you are. So I'm on that journey with you.
You got to give that one another try. That's too perfect.
And then on the other thing about writer's block, I just think, you know, there's seasons for everything. I don't worry about it too much. Do you? I mean,
is it an outmoded concept?
Oh, I didn't hear that.
And you might look at it that way. It what a prior generation called writer's block, we could probably understand better in terms of depression or some other disturbance of your mental and emotional faculties. And I don't know whether it would be productive, whether it would help you get out of the trough. And I'm fortunate that I have not ever had a really extended spell of writer's block, but I certainly know that many people have.
I can talk about this all day. From my own experience, depression is part of it. Fear is a lot of it. I've taught a lot of students, and I've found that a lot of them won't write because they're afraid it's not going to be perfect. And there's a very good book called Art and Fear. And one of the things in that book is the author says to my students or to anyone, says, what in your life have you ever done up to this point that was perfect? And the answer to that's, well, nothing. So then why would you think this is going to ever be perfect? So go ahead and just get it written. And the problem with writer's block, I feel, is that you've got to get it. One thing you can do if you're stuck is to write very ruthlessly, honestly, on why you're blocked. Don't worry about what the task is. Write about why you can't attack the task and be completely truthful, and that will help you a lot. For me, I have to sit down and write. I can't walk up and down the beach and solve my problem. I can only think with my fingers. And I have to make myself just sit down and do it, knowing that it's going to be useless, knowing that it won't be any good, knowing that I have to fill 10 pages until finally something will come that's good. And then I'll solve the problem. But my world championship day was 4 naps in a day due to depression because I couldn't get anything written that was any good. Just take a nap, get up, try again, fail, take another nap, get up and fail. And then finally, one day, if I sit there long enough, I'll solve the problem. But for me, I can't solve the problem if I'm not sitting there. But eventually, and I've been doing this a long, long time, and I now know that if I sit there long enough, I will solve the problem. And this is, it's like when your first girlfriend dumps you, you think you're never, ever going to survive it. When your 19th girlfriend dumps you, the pain is just as bad, but at least now you know you can survive it. And that's what writer's block is to me.
I might want to do something different. If the 19th girlfriend has dumped you, you might want to do something different.
Well, I didn't. I was hoping that no one would notice that point. But it's... I didn't ever... 14.
Okay.
Maybe. Okay. But it's hard. I mean, that's the main thing. It's hard, but writing is such a lonely thing because you're sitting alone in a room and doing it, and you think you're the only person that's ever had this problem. And everybody has, it's hard for everybody. It's hard. Michael Crichton, Andromeda Strain, and a zillion other books to Jurassic Park and Airframe and after that, he didn't think he could write. And so in his office, he had a copy of every single book he'd written in every single language it was translated into, so he could look at it and go, I did that. Okay, I can do this.
Wow.
So if it bothered him,
wow,
have at it. Yes, sir.
I have been from Pakistan. I appreciate this discussion. And I'm trying to write a book that's very challenging for me. Trying to write the biography of some ancient Sufis on my area. It's very mountainous and backward area, and there's not a lot of writers or academic activities. So I have collected information about around 90 Sufis, starting from the 9th century, 13th century, maybe, to the present day. But I'm facing a difficulty that for some Sufis, I only know their names, and there is no literary written sources available. Only the information available is the stories, traditional stories from their grandsons, from the pupils of their pupils. So how much that information is worth while to include in the book? Because no other sources available, just stories.
Wow. That's a really tough question. Let me go at it from my point of view, which is as a screenwriter where it's fiction, but let's say I've done a lot of research. And this is where I've gotten in trouble with my own work. As I said, I did so much research, I couldn't tell the story anymore. And so you've got to decide what you want your book to be. And then is this going to be a comprehensive list of everything that's known to man about all these people? Or are you going to have... Is your book going to be concentrating on one particular thread, and you're going to pick the 20 that are the most important that tell that story? And if you want to tell it all, you can tell it all, but you have to be sure that you're doing the book that you really want to do. It makes me nervous thinking about it's going to all be in there. Is that going to be the most readable, interesting book that's going to make the point that you really want to make, or do you want to tell it all? What did you think?
Well, you're up against the issue of how much you want to trust the oral tradition that's passing these stories down to you. I think readers understand if you set up the way you tell the story properly, readers understand that you're presenting something that has come down in oral tradition, not something that there is an actual documented source for. I don't think that makes it worthless information, especially if there are themes in the lives and the activities of these Sufis that recur and that have been passed on in that oral tradition. If the specific instances are lost to history, the themes probably still have some value.
I think it's like it really relates to what you were talking about, writing in the mother stamp too. And that, I mean, we come, most of us in our religious heritage have come from the oral tradition. I mean, that's where we get our story. That's where most of it comes from. And we don't think of it as lost. We think of it as preserved. And for me to, how does the Sufi tradition come down and how is it preserved? And how is it passed down is as interesting as the tradition itself, and how is it kept alive? Right now, I'm trying to figure out, how is that story preserved the best? And the golden pieces of that will then pass it down to the next generation is what I imagine what is partly of the motivation of it is to preserve it and capture it and share it to pass it on down. And what the most truthfulness of that means that you have to tell the stories that enable that history to continue. So whatever is like the golden nuggets of it, if it's a story that is just an oral story, but that's where something was crystallized in tradition. That's where the mysticism came out in a different way for this particular person. That would be what I would long to read, personally.
Yeah, my basic concern is to preserve that. Otherwise, the whole thing will be, nobody will even know the name. The name will be
so beautiful.
So at least whatever is available should preserve by making it very, trying it to be very authentic. When I put questions, cross questions to those people, and then try to not writing everything from the interview, but I use my own wisdom and what can be true, and I just relate from the important historical event. So my concern is just to preserve things, to be a good contribution for the society. If no preservation, then after some years, nobody will just know anybody's name.
Mm-hmm. How far are you into the actual writing of it?
Yeah.
How much have you already written?
I have collected some pages, so it's... Out of them, some information I personally don't view that it will be 100% correct, because that is the memorization of the also is degrading, because it is 200 years, 100 years ago, person is passed. You could say, I just know this, I listen from my father, and I know this. So, just I want to understand that the reader's perspective, how much that. Because the source is the oral instead of not preserving that, if we preserve and document that information, so is it a good thing to contribute to that? Just we neglect that or not enough information, don't mention it in the book.
It's a tough question. It's a difficult decision to have to make because you want to tell it all, but I'd write the draft the way you want to write the first draft. Get the one done that you want to do for yourself and please yourself, and then show it to people and hear what they have to say. But have an open mind to criticism.
But in my own country, I've met several academicians and students, scholars, and they were feedback for them, was very encouraging for me. They were saying, you are doing a great job, you are trying to preserve the history. There is no source available, written source or some other. I collected a lot of handwritten manuscripts also. People say you are doing a very good job, but I was just putting this question for my
I would get it the way you want it, and then see and look at it. Be happy with what you've written. I'd say that with everybody. I mean, when I sign my book, I always sign the same thing: enjoy your writing. Now I sign my name, but I think it's important for people to like what they're doing, because it's hard to do and you should enjoy it. I mean, it's painful at times, but overall have a good time doing it, because it beats, now I'm not going to say a job, because I'm sure half the people in the room will have that job. What time is it?
3:50.
One more question? Yes, sir.
Using the book Journals of the Self by Kathleen Adams. In that book, Jean Stindler, she speaks about Jean, the last name is spelled S-H-I-N-D-A.
Okay.
And the title of the book is Journals of the Self.
Mm-hmm.
But she speaks of outer meaning and inner events. No, outer events and inner meaning.
Yeah.
Between that is the birth meaning. And I come from a medical family. So my slang for writing is medical records. I mean, getting medical records to help survive. My mother lost a son before me. But that's why I studied medicine. But what I've discovered in this healthcare time, and I had the opportunity to interview the medical doctor, Dr. Ingram K. Jr., the Bishop, and he prepared me for something in reference to the future of health. I'm just going to throw that out.
Did you have something you wanted to add, John?
Yes. First of all, I just want to mention the fact that once more we're reminded of what a great library we have. And once more, Elise and Elaine are sitting back there. Just ask them to stand up, because... they make it possible. They have a great time. And I want to thank Becca and Tom and Will. I'd like to ask one brief question. I think what Will said about himself is so true in terms of what all of us who write think about. We write for ourselves, it seems to me. And there's an audience out there. We wouldn't be human if we didn't know that the audience is out there, and that it's out there and it's going to react. I'd like to ask Becca and Tom, to think for a moment about that audience that's out there. Sure, we're writing for ourselves, you're writing for yourselves. But there comes a time, sometimes, when the subject matter you're addressing in what you write is going to have an impact out there. As Will says, you know, we're not worried about that audience. Except sometimes there'll come a moment. Becca addresses the subject of sexual abuse. Tom, in a recent manuscript, takes a position that goes against the grain of what the police department here has said for 30 years or more. And those subjects, and the subjects that many of you are thinking about writing about, you among them, I mean, there's going to come a moment when what you write is going to have an impact out there. And I just ask the two of you, does it occur to you in the process of writing? Sure, Will's right. We're writing for ourselves, and we can't really care that much if we're going to be true, as Becca says, if we're going to have integrity in what we put down. But talk a little bit about when you know what you're writing is going to have an impact out there, going to jolt people, maybe shock people. Does it affect your writing at all?
Sure. I have to slow down. I speak in the present tense, although I'm not a journalist anymore. But as a journalist, I had to just pause at times. And often channel conversations I've had with you over the years, think through what the impact is going to be of, say, exposing the leader of one of the factions in the fairgrounds dispute a few years ago as a sex offender. When I learned that, and he had become prominent publicly, and that was relevant, and I was going to have to put it out there. Of course, I called him, you know. But any number of times, I've had information in my hands that was going to hurt somebody, that was going to have a real negative impact. That, in the case of Richard Osias, was going to run somebody out of town. And I have always tried to be as careful and prudent as I can be. You tell the story as you have to tell it, and you've been in many more of these situations than I have, but I tried to be aware at all times of just what the consequences might be of what I was doing. And there are stories I haven't told for that reason. Lots of them, in fact.
Mm. What are they? Those are the ones you want to hear, right?
Yeah.
That's the other thing about it. And I would say that for me, two things. One is I tried to be, at least in this book, respectful of the people who I've named as the abuser, the role of abuser in different things, because I think it's pretty damning for people, and it's pretty hard to wear that banner, as much as hard as it is to wear a victim banner or any of those other banners that we put on each other. And, one line in there I remember writing was about people who are survivors of sexual abuse in general have a lot of trouble with authority, that, you know, it's kind of full of landmines and traps. And I said, and you know, especially for me, for older men, that's been the harder place for me to have authentic relationship or be peers with people. So you can imagine in the hierarchy of the church how well that I've done. And I said, especially it's not been very helpful in my history, my last 22 years of ordination with bishops. It's been a miserable failure. And I thought, as soon as I write that, like, I'm just, you know, the only person I'm hurting is myself, really. I mean, I know Carolyn, his wife, is probably going to read the book. You know, but it's like, it's about him or it's about me or whatever it's about. But if you want to write it, I thought about it, and I thought about the audience that was reading it, and just thought, it's kind of nice to be done with it, to let stuff go and write it, and then it almost is like taking something that is inside of you and letting it go. And so just I'll deal with it when it comes back to me, but right now it's gone, and it'll come back maybe. The other thing I've really been thinking about a lot lately, especially we have literally about 30 states already signed up to be a part of this national conference that we've decided we're hosting. We just made it up, and we're hosting this national conference, which is how this stuff happens, right? You just go, oh, well, we could host a national conference. So people are coming from all over the country. You put something out there, and it starts coming back, and you say, now I have to be big enough to do this. If I've put something out there, and it's had an impact, and it's coming back, that's when it's like, I'm not shrinking from this. You know, I'm not going to be afraid of being bigger than I am now tomorrow to speak what truth needs to be spoken. And so both those things happen for me in the process.
I leave it to them.
Well, let's join in. Thank you.
Wait, before we do that, can I ask you one? Please, please, will you say that we've been to the cafe and it's really nice if anybody wants to come?
Sure, I will. Are you very proud of it?
Yeah, I just need customers.
Yeah, well, it's on Charlotte at 40...
51st.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful place. I stopped in there in the morning for coffee and stopped there for lunch. And they're expanding the menu. You know, it's a wonderful thing we've done here. We'll, each week we do something we haven't ever done before. And I love giving a commercial of Becker's. I mean, it's not a coffee shop. It is it's a restaurant. And it's a great place to go. And Thistle Farms is a great, great place to go.
Thank you for doing
both
that.
Both of them are great to read.
Well,
let's give them, and will our moderator round of applause.